Welcome to Jonathan on Money, the personal finance podcast that brings you the latest insights and strategies to help you achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, Jonathan I. Shankman. On this podcast, we'll cover everything from investing, financial planning, retirement, and behavioral finance. I'll share advice and practical tips to help you make the most of your money. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your finances to the next level, Jonathan on Money is here to help. Let's dive into this week's show. Welcome to this week's episode of Jonathan on Money. This is episode number 47. So it's been a pretty busy week between the podcast, daily financial planning videos, which you could find on YouTube, by the way, articles, webinars, and working with over 100 families. Every day is an adventure. I'm also planning on starting a client quarterly newsletter and have some other projects in the works, so stay tuned for that. Something I've been thinking about often, being so busy, is that the truth is it's good to be busy. I've noticed that for folks who are not busy, especially those in retirement, they tend to look for problems and issues. They also begin to deteriorate physically and mentally. If you're looking how to live a fuller, richer, and more fulfilling life, the key is staying active. It's far better to be tired from doing productive work than to be well-rested and only looking for problems. Just something to be mindful of. Okay, so as always, I have an insanely awesome show today. My talking points this week will discuss money lessons from and what we can learn from the Golden Calf, Vanderbilt, and the Turo Synagogue. We'll also discuss an important quote from Warren Buffett about leaving a legacy to your children. And as always, I'll spend the last half of the episode answering listener questions. With that, let's jump into this week's talking points. So a few weekends ago, Jewish people around the world read the Torah portion, Parshat Ki Tisa, in synagogue, which includes one of the more troubling episodes in the Jewish nation's history. The Torah tells us that the Israelites believed that Moshe was late in coming down from Har Sinai after receiving the Ten Commandments. The people became impatient and demanded that Aaron create a god for them to worship. In an effort to stall, he told them to collect jewelry. Ultimately, they melted it down and created a golden calf to worship. While the thought of worshiping another god likely seems foreign to many listeners, I can't help but appreciate the parallels to our society's golden god in the form of materialism. The pursuit of material possessions is a relatable temptation for many. It is a major challenge in frum communities around the country as people chase gashmius in the form of luxurious cars, McMansions, exotic Pesach programs, and designer clothes, to name just a few. In truth, there is nothing wrong with having nice things or going on luxury vacations. I've previously written about my firm belief that Torah encourages us to be prosperous and live a comfortable life. The important distinction is not to let money and the things money can buy define who you are. If our self-worth is tied to our possessions, it will only lead to struggles, heartache, and an unfulfilling life. Sadly, I can share countless stories of how money drove families apart and inhibited folks from achieving their full potential. When I meet with affluent families, I endeavor to frame money as a tool and not as a scorecard. Communicating this viewpoint is often even more impactful than the investment recommendations or tax mitigation strategies I implement on their behalf. A healthy relationship with money will likely lead to a better family life, broader societal impact, and a potentially larger nest egg. I share the following three thoughts with my wealthy clients to help them avoid having their money become a stumbling block. The first is that all we have comes from Hashem. A helpful perspective in life is to remember that all our material success comes from God. We're simply stewards of that money He has given us, and therefore it is incumbent upon us to act in a manner befitting this role. This includes utilizing our funds in a way that is aligned with our Jewish values. It also means maintaining a level of humility, being grateful for what you have, and not broadcasting your life for the world to see, because what Hashem gives, He can also take away. The second is that money shouldn't define who you are. There are many more important facets of life beyond just your bank account or income that should influence your character. These include family, community, Torah study, charitable work, various other dimensions of life. Hopefully these factors play into how we define ourselves rather than letting money become the essence of our identity. A focus on money can be all-encompassing. If your values are not more impactful than your money's influence over you, then your wealth will bring you down. The third is tzedakah is the ultimate remedy. The antidote to being consumed by money is to view it through the lens of selflessness. This means generously giving both of your time and money to people or organizations in need. It also means teaching future generations that having money brings a responsibility to lift others who need assistance. Being blessed with money can quickly turn into a curse if it is hoarded or becomes a status symbol instead of using it in a way to benefit the broader community. All this brings to mind some lessons I learned from a visit to Newport, Rhode Island. So a few years ago, my wife had a business trip meeting in Newport. Since the hotel and rental car were paid for by her company, I obviously decided to tag along. The hotel was near two tourist attractions that I wanted to visit, the Breakers and the Toro Synagogue. So while my wife was in meetings all day, I took the opportunity to explore. The Breakers is a Gilded Age mansion that was built in the late 1800s as a summer residence for Cornelius Vanderbilt II, a member of the wealthy Vanderbilt family. The five-floor, 70-room mansion has a gross area of 138,300 square feet. The entrance is marked by sculpted iron gates, and a limestone and iron fence borders the property. The edge of the estate is on a cliff overlooking Easton Bay of the Atlantic Ocean. And walking through that house, the word that often came to my mind was extravagance. Unfortunately, the Vanderbilt family's immense fortune was depleted within a few generations due to the excessive lifestyle and poor management of their funds. On the other hand, the Toro Synagogue, while still beautiful, is a much more modest structure. It was built in 1763 by wealthy Jewish businessmen who decided to donate money to establish a place for Jewish worship in the New World. It is the oldest surviving synagogue building in the United States and is still used for Orthodox services with approximately 175 member families. The Breakers represents what happens when you are engulfed by materialism, while the Toro Synagogue represents what happens when timeless and virtuous values influence the way you use your money. The Vanderbilts spent their wealth on all the most lavish forms of luxury, but now their home is a relic of the past. It's nothing more than a two-hour sightseeing tour on your way to your next location. In contrast, the Toro Synagogue is still in use more than 260 years later. Jews are thriving professionally and religiously all across the United States today, thanks in no small part to this little shul in Newport, where the first seeds of Yiddishkeit in the U.S. were planted. As you take stock of your financial situation, it's important to assess your values. Do you want to worship your money and possessions, or do you want your values to influence how you use your money? Choose wisely, as your legacy depends on it. Okay, those are the talking points for this week. And as a reminder, you can be notified of all my recent articles, webinars, and all the other work I put out by subscribing to my free monthly newsletter at parkbridgewealth.com/newsletter. We're currently at 8,500 subscribers and growing, so feel free to sign up and invite your friends as well. Now for this week's money quote, which is from the legendary investor Warren Buffett, who said, "Give your kids enough money, give your kids enough so they can do anything, but not so much that they'll do nothing." I don't need to give any background to listeners on who Warren Buffett is, so I'll just discuss why I love this quote. So money can be a motivator when you don't have enough of it to support your lifestyle, or can it be a demotivator where you coast through life and do nothing? We all know people who are motivated and work hard to make money. They create businesses, products, services, etc. Money, when used the right way, can unleash super creativity. In that sense, money may be a good thing. We also all know people who have family wealth and pretty much don't do anything. They just coast through life and have little to no impact on society or their social community or their local community. And this is sad. Striking the exact balance and how much financial support to give your children is difficult. It's probably different for each kid. The key is giving them enough to pursue their dreams and achieve something on their own, but not enough where they coast through life. Now let's jump into this week's financial questions. If you do have a question, feel free to submit it to me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com, and it may be answered in a future episode. Okay, first question. This may be a basic question, but what is the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and why should I care? This is a good question that many people probably don't know the answer to. The S&P 500 measures the value of the stocks of the 500 largest companies by market value. The purpose of it is to have a price that provides a quick look at how the stock market is doing. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is a stock market index that tracks 30 large publicly traded companies. It is named after Charles Dow, who created the index in 1896, along with his business partner, Edward Jones. The index is considered to be a gauge of the broader U.S. economy. For context, there are about 3,700 or so stocks in the U.S. Therefore, the S&P 500 gives a better picture of how the U.S. stock market is doing. The Dow Jones is very frequently quoted, but less relevant to your life since it represents only 30 stocks. However, if the S&P 500 goes up and you own a lot of U.S. stocks, which is likely, it means you're probably making money. That's why you should care. The day-to-day moves shouldn't impact your life. The important thing is that it goes up over time. And in the short, you are rooting for the S&P 500 to go up. Next question. With inflation projected to be 10% annually, how do you recommend growing one's money above inflation without using Bitcoin? So who is projecting inflation to go up 10% annually? You sound like a Bitcoin bro. I wouldn't be surprised if you had a man bun and are trading crypto in your parents' basement while smoking hookah and watering your weed plants. Regardless, it is unlikely that inflation will go up 10% annually. I would stick to historical norms, which is 2 to 4% annually. Since 2 to 4% is more likely to occur, stocks will likely outpace these metrics. So if you want to maintain your buying power, then invest heavily in stocks. Doing anything extreme or planning for a far-fetched scenario like you are describing does not make sense. Okay, the next question is, I'm 42 years old and just got laid off. I have about 3 months in an emergency fund and will receive 6 months of severance. What's my next financial move? Your next financial move is to get a new job. You need an income to pay your bills and build your wealth. Thankfully, you have a bit of a financial cushion, but 6 months goes by in a flash. So you should put together that resume and make it happen. I remember when I got laid off during the financial crisis at 23 years old, I had minimal expenses. You know, I had rent, but I split my rent with nine other roommates and gas, but you know, without a job, I didn't have many places to go. The next morning after I got fired, I put on a suit and started applying for jobs. Since the world was imploding in 2009, it took some time to secure a new gig, 9 months to be exact, although I got an offer after 4 months and they just kept delaying my start date. When I realized I wasn't going to start working anytime soon, I had an ample cash flow from employment benefits that the government kept extending. And I began eating out shawarma every night for a few nights a week and then traveled to Miami, to Costa Rica on unemployment money. After some time of chillaxing and living the good life, I became bored out of my mind and told the hiring manager of the firm that made me an offer that I need to start working ASAP, even though the financial world was in flux. I deteriorated to wearing PJs all day and ranting on my blog about the shidduch scene. There's no real moral to this story. Maybe my point is that if you don't get a job, you'll spend the whole day in your PJs and eating Middle Eastern food every night for dinner, which doesn't sound so bad now that I think about it, but it is frowned upon by society. Next question. I'm getting married a bit later than most of my friends. Thankfully, I found a lovely match. She happens to come from an exceptionally wealthy family. We both work, but her dad is eager to pay all our living expenses and then some. Should I take his money? So this is a fascinating question because there are various forces at play here. First, it's rude to not take his money. It's very generous and you should act appreciative by accepting it. Otherwise, there will be weird tension. Second, when someone gives you money, there are usually strings attached or at the very least, certain expectations that may impact your life. It's always best to be in control of your financial life and not have outsiders dictate what you should or should not be doing. Three, receiving a significant amount of money every year will cause you to modify your lifestyle where you are living beyond what you can afford. This is not a healthy situation to be in. Let's say the money stops coming in. You will not be able to easily tone down your lifestyle and end up spending beyond what you can actually afford, and you may end up in debt. Four, receiving money without doing anything will cause you to lose. You will lose your drive, personality, motivation, passion, and purpose in life. People like to kvetch about working, but working is healthy, and I mentioned this at the top of my show. Furthermore, whether people like to admit it or not, much of one's identity is tied to their work. And that's not a bad thing. It's important and makes people productive and purpose-driven. A possible solution to your predicament is to take the money you are generously given and put it aside, perhaps in a trust or just another account, and use it strictly to pay for simchas or your kids' expenses, perhaps helping your kids buy a house when the time comes. This approach will hopefully allow you to maintain your independence and all the benefits that come up with working hard. It should also make you look appreciative since you are accepting the money to help with important expenses for your life. Can I retire just on the dividend income from holding one position, namely the S&P 500 ETFs, and that's it? So the current dividend yield for the S&P 500 is only around 1.5%, and that's low relative to history. Since 1950, the S&P 500 had an average dividend yield of 3.1%. However, the average has been going down for a while. This century, the average yield is just 1.8%. The modest cash flow is probably not enough to pay your bills. The good news is that dividends tend to grow over time. Since 1950, the annual growth rate on dividends has been about 5.7% per year, which is higher than 3.5% inflation over that time period. Dividends also tend to go up annually, but when they don't go up, they can mess up your retirement plan. For example, dividends fell nearly 25% during the financial crisis. 25% less income from 1 year to the next is brutal. If you buy individual stocks and the economy is weak, the dividend can be eliminated from one day to the next with no warning. That's a very tough situation to be in. A better approach than relying just on dividend is implementing a total return strategy in retirement. This means creating your own cash flow through a combination of dividends from stocks, income from bonds, and capital appreciation from selling stocks that have appreciated in value. You then make sure that your safe withdrawal rate is appropriate to meet your living expenses and not outlive your funds. This is a far more prudent approach to generating cash flow in retirement than relying solely on dividends. You should stay diversified with your investments and income streams in retirement. Next question, what are your thoughts on fund-to-funds? First, the definition for those who are not familiar. So fund-to-funds are also known as multi-manager investments, which are pooled investment funds that invest in other types of funds. Basically, it's a portfolio that contains different underlying money managers like hedge funds or mutual funds. My thoughts are these are great vehicles if you like paying layers of high fees for people to pick managers that will likely underperform their respective benchmark. When I worked in corporate America, every so often one of these funds would present in the office, and I'd go to these presentations because sometimes they would buy me lunch from Mendy's. Then they stopped with the kosher food because it wasn't in the budget anymore, and I could find better ways to waste my time. Anyway, the fund-to-fund people sound impressive and have a great pedigree, but why would I allocate capital to hedge funds that are already expensive and then pay an additional fee to the fund-to-fund manager? And then ask my client to pay me a fee on top of all that for the fund-to-fund's lackluster performance? The answer is I wouldn't do that because it's insane. Next question, do you use ChatGPT to write your articles? No, I'm old school. When I write an article, I first make an outline and then think of something to say for each section, and then I write it. Then I revise it, then I revise it again, then I have someone else read it over so it doesn't sound like trash, then I revise it more. Then I send it to the editor at the place it is getting published, and they usually make a change or three. That being said, I'm all about embracing new technology, and I actually asked ChatGPT to write about a particular personal finance topic. Sadly, it was a fluff piece with literally no substance at all, so it would actually probably be worthy of getting published in many of today's media outlets since they also stink. But this is not up to the high quality standards of Jonathan I. Shankman. Next question, I could pay an advisor 1% of my portfolio to help me, or I can keep that 1% and do it myself, only 1% ahead compounded over time. What am I missing? You're missing something huge, which is the fact that you're assuming you will make the same investment and financial planning decisions without an advisor. You likely won't, hence the fee. I read and I listened to a lot of do-it-yourself investors who make the claim that they will be richer by saving on an advisory fee. They're also all just making the same assumption. They are also assuming they will actually implement the strategy properly and will stick with it. They won't. That's why most people need a financial advisor. Next question. I'm looking for a financial advisor, but everyone I had spoken to charges a percentage of assets under management. This is an absurd business model. Why don't more advisors charge a normal hourly fee like a lawyer? So have you ever worked with a lawyer? Is their fee structure really more reasonable? They are compensated for being inefficient. That's what an hourly rate incentivizes, to work slowly, inefficiently, and without any sense of urgency. If they are sloppy, it's even better because they will need to revise their work, which allows them to bill more hours. Speaking of hours, lawyers need to bill a certain amount of hours every year at most firms, so they would drag their feet to get in those hours. Also, do you actually believe they are working all the hours they claim? How do you prove they are actually working and not schmoozing about politics with their colleagues or checking their fantasy team or in the bathroom? And what about all those rookie lawyers who charge a boatload of money but don't actually know anything and need to ask their boss? You're paying for them to take the time to learn on the job, which is insane. This is the fee structure that you're using as an example of being optimal. All that being said, there are also advisors who charge project-based fees, which make more sense than hourly. I still believe the assets under management or AUM model makes the most sense for the most people. As you make more money, the advisor makes more money, so you're sitting on the same side of the table. You don't need to worry about paying to ask a simple question or even a more involved one. It's all included. Also, an AUM advisor actually implements a strategy for you, so you don't procrastinate, which is a major challenge for most do-it-yourself investors. I get that an AUM model may not work for you. Everybody's different. Thankfully, there are other fee models to choose from. You just need to find a competent advisor in whatever fee model you are choosing. And please note, the lawyers I know are all worth their fee and honest. I'm just talking about all the other lawyers out there. Next question. A lot of people that manage their own money say I should work exclusively with Vanguard. Why is that? Vanguard is cheap, so they are the darling of many do-it-yourself investors. They have some good products, and I use them when designing some client portfolios. It's worth pointing out, though, that they are not the cheapest anymore. You could get the same strategy at one of their competitors for cheaper if you know what you're doing. Additionally, and this is anecdotal, calling them up to get something done has been a challenge, and the wait time has been longer. I've heard this from investors who told me the service at other firms has been better. A final thing I'll point out is if you are asking Vanguard for advice, they are primarily looking to push their own products to you. That's how they make money. Again, they have many good options, but anyone who can only recommend investment vehicles that their firm is creating has a conflict of interest, and I would proceed very cautiously. To sum up this rant succinctly, Vanguard equals good and cheap, but not the best or the cheapest, and be careful. Okay, that's it for financial questions this week. Again, feel free to email me with any questions you have, and I might answer them in a future episode. And you can reach me again at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Additionally, if you could take a minute to subscribe to this podcast and rate this show on Apple or Spotify, it will help other personal finance enthusiasts find this show as well. And with that, it's a wrap for this week's show. Any comments or questions, feel free to reach out directly to me via email. I love hearing from my listeners. And finally, the secret to financial success is no secret at all. It's to spend less than you make, invest the difference prudently, and ignore all the noise. See you next time on Jonathan on Money. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I hope you were able to take away a nugget or two to apply to your own life. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you can be alerted whenever new episodes drop. If you'd like to submit a question that may be answered in a future show, please email me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Be sure to check out all Jonathan on Money content, including all of my articles, webinars, and videos by following me at Jonathan on Money on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Finally, if you like what you heard today, please rate the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This helps ensure that other personal finance enthusiasts can find the show as well. Thank you, and catch you on the next episode of Jonathan on Money.